Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, I know we've got a little bit of a history lesson today. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't call it a history lesson. It's a very interesting history lesson at that, but it's a perspective. Believe it or not, everybody's heard of EB5 without really understanding where EB5's come from or knowing anything about the history of EB5. So we thought it would be a wonderful idea to have someone who was preeminently qualified to be able to discuss this area with us.
That's right, Mona. Today we have Maury Buray. Maury has had a distinguished record of accomplishment spanning his 35-year career in U.S. federal government. During that time, he was the USCIS headquarters EB-5 program manager and chief adjudications officer in charge of the EB-5 immigrant investor program. It was there he took the very small and struggling program at the end of 2000, established a foundation, and fortified it with process to enable the EB-5 program to flourish and grow. Grow to what, I hear you ask, loyal EB5 Investment Voice listener? About $1 billion per year of immigrant investments, which is often paired with domestic sources of capital and thus created thousands of jobs for American workers throughout the U.S. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Maury, I'm sure Mona's going to ask a few questions on how we got to where we are today based off what's happened in the past. But I was hoping before we get started, you'd give us a little historical perspective on the EB-5 program.
It comes from Shakespeare's that what is past is prologue. And basically, I think that the historical antecedents are important. For somebody who's been around as long as I have on both sides, within the government and outside, what goes around comes around. I see it happening on a basis. So, you know, when EB-5 was first created by the Immigration Act of 1990. The program started slow and small and really wasn't going anywhere.
It's huge today. Why do you feel back then it really wasn't going anywhere?
There were so few people that could afford to come in and start companies and be so involved that they were predominantly involved in a business. So in 93, Congress created what was called the pilot program. And the pilot program essentially was regional centers. And it was initially called a pilot program because they wanted to see how it worked out. And regional centers made possible the concept of indirect jobs. The key thing with the regional center, there are two key points that regional centers enabled. One is that you could be credited for indirect jobs using an economic methodology, a job creation model. And two, your investment could be into a fund that the fund could loan money. You could have the fund in between. So the NCE and the JCE, the new commercial enterprise and the job creating enterprise, could be separate. They could be different. Rather, with a non-regional center, they have to be one and the same.
So with those key advantages of the EB-5 Regional Center pilot program, how did that help it grow, evolve, and change?
So then after 93, you know, we grew to where we had about 65 regional centers, and we really got up to over 1,000 investors a year and up to 2,500, which was getting us into the range of 3,000 to 5,000 visas per annum. We still never hit the 10,000 mark, so we never got into visa retrogression because visas could be shared.
So we have this immigration investment program. It's got a couple of benefits. It's growing. We haven't hit a ceiling yet. Did the happy story continue?
It was discovered by the Department of State in an interview for an EB-5 investor that fraud was being conducted. The investor let go in the interview how the structure of the funding was and how they had only invested $150,000 and how they were promised that they would not, that the rest was a promissory note and they didn't have to pay it and it would be a balloon payment. Well, that report came back to Legacy INS. And we started to look into cases and we realized that this scam was going on. It was a very clever scam saying, technically, we're following the law. And the deal was back then, somebody could invest at the 5-2-6 stage, and then they would, say, have a 5-year note that would have a balloon payment. They'd make small payments in increments over the years. And in the fifth year, they were held to a balloon payment. By the fifth year, their unconditional card would be approved and the loan could be forgiven.
So what happened when that came to light?
We discovered that. And so we suspended the program in 1997 and worked on the issues that were most problematic and most troubling. And that's what was the basis for the precedent decisions. And four cases of I-526 cases were picked. And those cases became the foundation for what became the four precedent decisions.
Without diving into the details of those precedent decisions, because I'm sure that will take a lot of time, did you stop there?
So then after that, I came up with the 5-year window for a project based on the IRS. Established the idea that a regional center needed to be a contiguous geographic area. Prior to that, we had regional centers that were in 3 different states, but there was no connectivity between them.
So that's the geographic glue that we recognize today that bounds the area of a regional center together. But going back earlier to what you were talking about fraud, did you set up any ongoing procedures?
I remember asking the folks that adjudicated cases, I said, so when you approve a regional center, what do you do after that? And they all went, nothing. I said, nothing? You just designate it and nothing else happens? So I established the annual review, that is the annual report by regional centers that they had to get back and report on what is it they were doing, you know, in response to their what they are approved to do.
How did the paperwork to do all this change?
For regional centers, there was no form. It was basically some people submitted a package addressing the requirements of the regulation, and there was no standard format or anything. And so that's where we came up with the I-924. And there was no fee. You know, applying to be a regional center was free, and doing the annual report was free.
Well, no fee filings are certainly an item in history now. Did you do anything else to ensure that the EB-5 program made a positive economic impact?
We got into industry categories, established that. I thought it was important for, you know, what is it you're really going to do? What energy or industries are you going to focus in on? It was not a question of just, you know, blindfold, throw a dart against a dartboard. You had to have some plan for what you wanted to do to improve the economy in the region that you were focusing on.
Well, Maury, thank you so much for that look back on the EB-5 program. It's good to hear that it didn't evolve inside of a silo, that you actually look to see what investors were doing, what regional centers were doing, what changes need to be made in the program and implemented those.
Well, you are somebody who has seen the program from both sides, from both the government side and from the EB-5 stakeholder sides. In fact, I do recall in the early days of EB-5, in fact, when we applied for the first regional center in New York, NYCRC, there were only 14 regional centers and there wasn't even any particular form to file a regional center designation.
That's correct. In fact, when I took over the program, since its inception between 1991, when the program was first created, until 2009, there were no forms.
Wow. Well, it certainly jumped to what we have today. Did you ever think this program would grow to the extent it has?
No, honestly, you know, in the beginning, I will say from 93 through 98, we actually had 65 regional centers that were approved. And we got to a point of over as close to probably 1,400 to 2,000 investors. So actually the program grew quite large, but regrettably, one of the factors that enabled it to grow large was fraud.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, as we have discussed, we do get fraud in every part of immigration, every industry. And bear in mind how large EB-5 is today. I do always like to highlight that although there has been fraud, it has been a very small amount. Coming to that, what kind of oversight did you envisage when you were putting the Form 924 together and the whole program together?
Well, you know, what's interesting is when I first started to look at the program, after we came up with the precedent decisions, you know, 1998, we suspended the program 97 and 98 because of what happened with the fraud that we discovered. And we restarted the program, and we issued in 1998, we issued the four key precedent decisions that have to this day still guide the main legal precedents of the program. At that point, around 99-2000, we had 65 regional centers. And what we did is, after we issued the precedent decisions, we sent a letter out to the 65 regional centers basically saying you have 45 days to respond and reapply, recertify as a regional center to maintain your designation. And if you don't respond, you'll be automatically terminated. And we terminated 60. So we continued five, and then those five had to reapply and be recertified.
Yeah, in those early days, Maury, there really wasn't such an emphasis with SEC sort of regulations. I remember that at that time, even the PPMs were generic. They weren't even sort of SEC compliant.
Right, because we had no SEC expertise within what I call legacy INS, Immigration Naturalization Service, which existed prior to 2003. When USCIS became part of the Homeland Security when it was created. So back in the day, there was no SEC expertise. And I know when I ran the program, I reached out to the SEC, but they weren't interested. So we basically did our best with our own attorneys within USCIS.
At what point did the SEC become interested?
After I retired, I think when you started to see, I would say SEC became interested probably around 2011 and beyond, when you started to see these pooled investor capital of $100-200 million from, you know, 200 to 400 investors in a single pool, then you were looking at a scope and size and serious issues related to offerings that interested the SEC.
Well, you have to remember also that this began as an immigration program, and then somewhere in the middle, it started becoming an alternative capital program. And then at some point, once we had started getting so many people from China, which wasn't they were not the early investors, the South Koreans were the early investors, there were a number of cottage industries within EB-5 that sprung up.
Yes, there were. And one of the things under my years there, I did reach out to the Commerce Department and basically got input and assistance on understanding RIMS 2, which was developed by the Commerce Department to, you know, and the Department of Defense to initially analyze the impact of base closings. And then it became used as an input-output model for indirect job determination. And so Commerce was very helpful to us, and we used to consult with them in the early days till we sufficiently mastered that. And then the agency allowed us to employ a contract economist to assist us as well with the methodologies used for determining indirect jobs.
You know, Maury, we did discuss when we were talking about this podcast that lately one of the latest moves has been E2 to EB-5. And I think you discussed with me that the E2 program was something that you had adjudicated initially with the EB-5 in mind. There were a number of E2 to EB-5 cases using the old model prior to using the economic model. And nowadays, we are using E2 to EB-5 using regional centers.
Well, you know, E2, if you go back and study the E2 history,
yeah.
E2s, there was, you know, there wasn't a real job element in E2. E2 was basically substantial investment, and over 50% had to be the, you know, the foreign investor ownership of the business. And there was no capital threshold. There was no job requirement, no capital threshold. It was mainly technical in terms of what substantial meant and relative to the investor's role in the business, and that it be a treaty trader country. It had to be a country with a trade treaty with the United States. So that was E2. But when we first were tasked with creating EB-5, as you know, EB-5 initially was standalone before regional centers from 1991 yes. to 93. So the E2 served as a major input. That was the foundation to conceive and develop the regulations that became the EB-5 regulations.
Right. But E2s and standalones are all active entrepreneurial type programs, whereas EB5, the way we see it today, and the real money that's brought in are these pooled investments, and they are passive investments.
Right. That, in fact, the requirement for active involvement by the investor is something that you can tie directly to the E2 in that in a standalone, because that's when the program first was created, they required a demonstration that the investor was actively involved either at a policy level or in the day-to-day operation of the enterprise. So when you get to what you're talking about, the pooled investments, you get into the fact of what constitutes passive. And so what we did is, if you look at the regulation, it says as long as you're in compliance with the Limited Partnership Act of 1990, and it's been amended since, which basically, as long as all the rights and privileges provided under that act were shown, then that would constitute active involvement for essentially a passive investor.
Right. And then now the tying into your issue relating to fraud, if you have a passive investor, it's more likely than not that if any fraud type of cases would come up more with the passive investment, right?
I actually seen it in both ways.
Ah, interesting.
Yes. Fraud has existed in ways of misallocation of capital that was committed to the business or a source of capital. Like one of the things of fraud was what we call showing an investor to invest $500,000 when in reality they didn't invest $500,000. They invested less, and using a process that we call smoke and mirrors of moving capital from one account to another to make it appear that the investor had sourced $500,000 in a TEA. We do have some million-dollar investors and non-TEAs, but in the standalone is where you'll see the non-TEAs. In the regional centers, those are all TEAs.
Yeah, we often discuss this with people who want to do their own standalone, and we really tell them about the inadequacies of the capital of $500,000. It just doesn't work. It works with a pooled investment, but there's very few businesses where you can really sustain 10 employees, sustain the business rather, with the 10 employees with only 500,000.
Yeah, and that's where you go into the concept also of job sharing. Say you're opening a restaurant. Most typically in the standalones were restaurants or franchises like Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's or something like that. And as you know, you've got jobs that are required. And a job itself, I think this is an important point to make, is you got to focus on the job, not the person.
Yes.
One of the biggest flaws that occurs, and especially also among attorneys, immigration attorneys, is they're so focused on the qualifying employees and having 10 of those. Well, you can have 20 employees for 10 jobs, as long as the jobs require 35 hours a week of work. So you can show that you have more than one employee. So you just have to meet the standard for what is considered job sharing, which is basically you need a position, say a cashier. You have to have a cashier as long as you're open for business. And maybe you need a cashier 60 hours a week, but you could say I'm going to create three separate cashier jobs on different shifts, and those are going to be shared.
You know, we've been arguing this for an awful long time, and then we were so happy the year before last, when USCIS came up with their memorandum relating to jobs. Which leads me to one of the questions. As soon as everybody found out in our office that you were going to be a guest on our podcast series, they bombarded me with questions. And one of the questions that they asked was, how does USCIS come up with policy memorandums? How do they update the policy manual? Do they listen to us attorneys in our arguments? Do they write the RFEs down? How do they do this?
Well, I can only go back to my own personal time, prior to 2010. And I would see in the Constitution of Doing Business, we would look at an I-526 and we'd look at the filings or we'd look at a regional center and realize there were some issues that were not clear in regulation and clearly were not clear in any terms of any established standard. And that's where we did the operational memorandums, which were guidance. We would prepare a memorandum to address what constitutes capital, for instance, even though you have the regulation saying a definition of capital. For instance, you know, once we had the president decision, like if you have a Zoomie, one of the things that a Zoomie allows, for instance, is that a lot of people don't realize this, is that I, as an investor, say I invest into a NCE, I could put $250,000 cash and I could give the NCE a promissory note for $250,000. As long as that promissory note is collateralized against my personal assets, which are seizable, and the collateral is fair market value established by standards of fair market value, and that I have a schedule of payment where I must pay the loan within a specified period of less than 2 years within the conditional residency, and no balloon payment at the end. It's got to be, and so by the time I get to the 526, if somebody did a promissory note as part of their investment, which a Zoomie allows, I would be looking at the payment schedule to show that they paid into the NCE as required by the agreement. But that is a rare model. That doesn't really operate anymore.
Right. But with regards to the policy memorandums, do USCIS listen to the stakeholders when we have our meetings and our requests? Because I know we've all written lots of letters to them.
Yeah, that becomes part of internal discussions, you know.
Right.
I mean, when we came up with the president decisions, I don't know if most of your listeners may be familiar with the Chang case that was a class action suit that was filed in I think it was filed around 2000 or 2001. And that had to do with the fact that we had I-526s, over 2,000 I-526s that were approved. And when we got to the IA-29s, we retroactively applied the president decisions. And the litigation was that we could not retroactively apply that. So what we had to do is address those cases without applying the president decisions retroactively. And so we had to produce what we call operational guidance and policy guidance to assist our adjudicators in how to adjudicate those cases.
Do you think USCIS are going to update the precedent decisions, like, for example, the recent decision relating to loans based on collateral?
Well, I don't think that that was a valid decision. It violated Izumi, in my opinion. So, you know, I mean, you have an established precedent decision, and a precedent decision is really difficult to have. I mean, it's got to pass.
Yeah.
It's got to be reviewed and approved all the way up through the Justice Department, even though, you know, today it'd be DHS. Precedent decision would have to be probably coordinated with the Office of Executive Review and others, because precedent decision has, basically, as you know, I mean, it's absolute. So once it's established, but to establish a precedent decision really requires a tremendous amount of agreement amongst different authorities.
True. But, you know, EB-5 is also 75% business development. And we often think that USCIS really does not look at the real world of business when they come up with their decisions.
Well, I think going in, I think what happens is you're getting a reaction. What my advice would be, when you're doing your business plan and you're laying out the details of the business, you need to have a section that explains the exact nature of that business and what factors may impact a rise and a fall. Like some businesses, it's not that they're seasonal, but like, for instance, in manufacturing of automobiles and automobile parts, you hit a period of where 2 months they'll suspend operations in a factory and suspend the work staff. But it's an industry standard. It's the way the industry operates, especially for retooling. You have to make that clear. You have to write clearly what is the nature of this business and how do the industry standards that apply to that business specifically apply to this particular job creating enterprise in which you're taking the EB-5 capital to create jobs. I think that you have to educate the adjudicator. And one way to do, like, for instance, in the dairy industry, you have to show the fact that you milk cows 3 times in 24 hours. Every 8 hours, cows must be milked 7 days a week.
Yeah.
365 days a year. You cannot not do that. Consequently, you have continuous, you know, in agriculture, you might have somebody who works 50 to 40 to 60 hours a week. Agriculture is exempted from overtime. So you can take that and show from an industry standard that you've created the equivalent of, you know, 2 jobs or 3 jobs, what it takes to staff and handle a dairy farm. So I remember after I left government, helping a dairy farmer in their petition, it clearly explained that to the agency. And in what was initially a denial based on job creation was reversed and was approved because of educating the agency and the adjudicator on what is in fact the industry reality and standard.
Maury, I can't stress enough as to how honored we are to have you here on the show and to really gain a benefit from your vast experience. One of the questions, again, my office begged me to ask you is, what advice would you give on areas where we have such little guidance, like redeployment? I mean, in this area, for example, we have real-time, real cases, and project asking us, can they redeploy money? Can they do this or can they do that? And we don't have any guidance. And even following events like at the IIUSA and other events where people are speaking about it, it's not satisfactory. And we're scared of saying the wrong thing and ending up with a lawsuit, you know, a few years from now.
Well, I'll give you my personal opinion. I mean, in that redeployment was never initially conceived as necessary because it was expected that, like, for instance, going back to history, the only reason projects are 5 years is I established the 5-year window for projects. And I base that on the IRS, which only allows a business to show losses for 5 years at the time. That's how the 5-year window came to be.
But it takes 5 years for any business to stabilize, though, right?
No, it does. And so that's what somebody once asked me. I remember in the early days, they said, well, how long does the investor have to keep their investment? You know, how long does the project have to go? And I said, 5 years. I would use the example of 5 years. I like the IRS standard. So that's where 5 years came from. A little bit of history there. And so when you're asking how you think about something, the reason I cited that is a lot of what occurs is what makes sense, what seems practical. And that's why I looked to the 5-year thing. I thought I felt security in saying, well, IRS has this established in terms of stabilizing a business. That seems like a safe standard to me. So on redeployment, now that you're looking at redeployment, I think it's important to say, wait a second. You know, if I'm redeploying, has the investor qualified? Has the investor, and the problem is yes and no. If an investor has been 2 years in conditional residency by the point of where you'd make a redeployment decision, that is, they've had the green card for 2 years, their money has been throughout the project, and it's been at risk, technically, if you look at the simple language of the regulation, they have satisfied the requirement relative to the 829. But what's hitting with redeployment is where you still got a lot of people that they haven't got their conditional residency yet. Their money has been invested. They're hitting up to the fifth year, let alone their unconditional. They haven't got their conditional. So one has to say, what does redeployment mean? And I think the agency has offered some decent general guidelines in saying, basically, like Mona, your regional center, you have a scope of what you do as a regional center. These are the industries I focus on. This is what we look at is the nature of our business enterprise and the projects we do, and this is what we do. And so I'd say as long as you stay within the strictures of what you were approved to do as a regional center, regardless of the geographic area, the fact is if the jobs have been created, if the money has been sustained, and now you have to redeploy it, you could redeploy it. If one of the things is that you invest in the construction loans, say you do construction loans for hotels, you could do another construction loan for the hotel. As long as the offering material as long as you have an agreement that the investor has signed on in the offering documents that one or a series of loans, that the NCE will make one or more loans over a period of time, and you have provisions for the fact that when you come to the end of the initial investment period, that there's a lawful provision for continuing. You can't just create a redeployment that is not allowed under the terms of the investment.
Okay, Maury, I see that you can't create a redeployment retroactive based off the existing terms of the investment. So keeping that in mind, are there any proactive things that could be done up front?
So what I would say is you've got to, in your operating agreement and your, you know, and the, what you're offering to the investor, you've got to make it clear today, you know, you have to think about what your redeployment is going to be and put it in the initial agreement. So when that 526 is approved, your redeployment is approved in because it's part and parcel of the business plan and the operating agreement and the whole all the things that constitute the offering.
Maury, thank you so much for coming on and giving us some good information about the historical evolution of EB-5 program, as well as how some of that has evolved into interpretations and implementations today. Sometimes on the show, we would like to give our very knowledgeable guests, such as yourself, a magic wand. And with this magic wand, Mona's laughing because it's really her wand. You can wave this magic wand and make whatever changes you want. But I want to do something a little different this time. I want to give you a time machine, whether that be a cool looking car, a boring blue phone booth, or heck, even a hot tub. I'm not going to judge, but I'll give you a time machine and a magic wand. I know this may be hard, since you were the EB-5 program manager and chief adjudications officer, but if you could travel back in time and wave your magic wand to change one thing about the EB-5 program, knowing what you know now, how would you use it?
I would use it to provide a provision where you wouldn't have to go through an additional 2 years once you showed with your initial investment, job creation and everything, if at the point of the 526, you've met all the requirements that would have technically gotten you an unconditional status, then my magic wand would be to provide that ability.
Yeah, that's amazing, Maury. I would love to have a private bill to do that, especially for all those poor people who have to wait in retrogression.
Yeah, that's another great use of the magic wand, this time coupled with the time machine. Maury Bure, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I really enjoyed talking with Mona.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.